Hi, this is Alan Chartok, and I'm delighted to be in conversation today with one of my favorite people in the world, Dr. Mark Pettis, a triple board certified internist, nephrologist, and integrative medicine physician practicing for over 25 years. Dr. Pettis currently serves as the director of medical education, wellness, and population health at Berkshire Health Systems in Western Massachusetts. In addition, he serves as the associate dean of medical education at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. In that capacity, he oversees undergraduate and graduate medical education at Berkshire Health Systems, a major affiliate of the medical school. Dr. Pettis is the physician lead on population health initiatives for Western Massachusetts. He's former chief of medicine at St. Peter's Hospital in Albany, New York. He is a clinical associate professor of medicine at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. He's the former medical director of the Kripalu Institute for Integrated Healing. He's the author of two books, The Savvy Patient, The Ultimate Advocate for Quality Healthcare, and It's All in Your Head, Change Your Mind, Change Your Health. He serves on the teaching faculty at the Center for Mind, Body, Medicine in D.C. and the Meditation Institute in Averill Park, New York. Dr. Pettis received his B.A. from Boston University and his M.D. from the University of Massachusetts Medical School. His postdoctoral training was at Harvard Medical School. He completed his renal fellowship at the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. Dr. Pettis is also an alumnus of the Advanced Program for Conflict Resolution, Negotiation, and Meditation at the Harvard School of Public Health. Mark Pettis has appeared on numerous TV and radio venues nationally, including the 700 Club, Good Morning America, NPR, and PBS. Dr. Pettis is married to Leanne, an RN, that's a registered nurse, he met as a resident in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He has two awesome children, Alex, age 22, and Anna, age 24. He loves sports, being outdoors, sunshine, the beach, and rock and roll. Dr. Pettis is here today to talk about physician burnout and much more. Welcome, Dr. Mark Pettis.
Thank you, Alan, for having me. Well, what an introduction.
This is not the first time we've had you, and it won't be the last time, because you are a great sage in our mind as to what we're thinking and how. You know, when I read your wonderful biography, which is extraordinary, I heard this mind-body connection going on and wellness going on. And I would think that because I'm a warrior and because I wake up for an hour every night in the middle of the night and think about how the governor or somebody else is going to get me, I wonder why I'm not dead yet.
There's a lot to worry about in our modern lives, for sure.
So tell me, I mean, if negativity in the soul, I know good people who've died, who are seemingly happy people, as opposed to people like me, we're not necessarily that happy. How do you deal with that?
Yeah.
Intellectually, how do you deal with it?
So in our crazy modern lives, Alan, there are so many ways that people interpret and respond to the events around them, some of which they have very little control or influence over, some of which they could profoundly change or influence. And, you know, we've known for a long time that stress and how we interpret and respond to our environments says a lot about how happy we are, how well we thrive, how long we live, and what is the likelihood along that life that we may acquire chronic complex diseases, right? These diseases that have become epidemic.
Like diabetes and other things.
Like diabetes, like obesity, like heart disease, stroke, Alzheimer's, which, you know, all of us are fearful of losing our capacity to think and to function. So we are very much wired to be roaming an environment that was much less complex than the one that we currently roam. And some of the things that I know we'll talk about over the course of this interview, Alan, challenge us to be more mindful with respect to how our environment is influencing how we, in fact, respond. And
for example,
for me, so an example of that would be, we are deeply hardwired for this fight-flight response, this response that prepares us to defend ourselves anytime we perceive a threat.
Yes.
And that response is right out of the African savannah. This is a deeply primal rooted response.
You mean they're not out to get me?
So in 21st century context, you know, hearing about a budget crisis, hearing about all of the geopolitical conflicts, being tuned in to 24/7 hubbub news information, a lot of which is very negative and in some respects very traumatic, even though we may not understand that to be an immediate threat to our lives, begins to take on the interpretation that we are indeed threatened. It might also take the form of, you know, getting the visa bill at the end of the month, dealing with teenagers in modern life, dealing with the complexities of our relationships and work and in our community. And while all of these things in and of themselves aren't genuinely threatening to us, there is a tendency for our fight-flight response to be activated quickly. And if we're not mindful of where that activation is taking us down this rabbit hole of poor health and lack of joy and challenge to thrive in one's life, then we lose that opportunity to kind of step back, to pause, to take that deep breath, and to reframe the interpretation. And I think that's part of what challenges us as modern humans. And so, you know, the practice of medicine, I started to really tune into this, Alan, about, I don't know, 15 years or so. And I know we've had many conversations in the past about sort of this evolution of mind-body science and more holistic approaches to care that begin to examine human beings, not so much as these sophisticated modern creatures, but as still very much of a Stone Age species, that whether it's the foods in our food supply now or the stresses in our lives or the 24/7 hubbub that can make it very hard to maintain connection with daily circadian rhythm relationships now that are defined by emails and text and less so by FaceTime, all of those aspects of modern living at the level of the brain are often perceived as threats. And once that fight-flight response begins to assume itself, the research is suggesting to us that fight-flight leads to elevations of blood pressure, changes in our breathing, changes in our metabolism, takes your immune system, Alan, and my immune system, it turns it on as if we were trying to fight influenza or another external risk, when in fact that immune inflammatory response may be a simple response to the news you're getting, to something that you're worried about. Our brains are not well designed to separate the true threat from a threat that may be important to us, but not one that requires that fight, flight, survival. So that's a bit of a long-winded response.
It's
just
good.
Some context, because I do think we're challenged more than ever.
But okay, so a couple of things. One, and maybe you could, you know, you could answer this seriatim, but one, we're all living longer. How come? And, you know, with all of that said, we're
yes.
living longer.
Yeah.
Okay. Number two, I've read at least one study that says those of us who worry are actually in better shape than those of us who do not. Mm. I mean, now these studies come out virtually every day.
Yeah.
And you never
yeah.
hear about them again, but there is some conflict about them.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And those are great points, Alan. So if you look at longevity.
Sure.
And if you compare how long we lived at the turn of the 19th century, 20th century to current, our life expectancy has almost doubled. And if you look at the greatest contributors to that longevity, most of it comes down to public health, improvements in sanitation, improvements in the quality of our water, the advent of antibiotics in the earliest 20th
sure.
century. But it's largely sort of the public health, certain breakthroughs like antibiotics that have allowed humans to live much longer than any generation before them. The downside, if there is a downside to living longer, is that as modern humans, we are now in this modern environment for a much longer period of time. And in that context, and the good news is we are living longer, the challenge there is the environment within which we are now living longer challenges us by exposing us to what I would consider environmental inputs that we are not well designed to be in relationship with, like processed foods, fast foods, GMO-based foods. If you look at the media and this 24/7 stimulation we have around events of the world, many of which are traumatic and deeply profound, if you look at how little time we spend outdoors, this loss of connection with nature, with natural full-spectrum sunlight, if you look at how even the nuclear family, Alan, you know, a generation, two generations ago, most of us can imagine being with our grandparents, being with our aunts and uncles. We all tended to be tightly connected. And there were survival advantages of our immediate and extended families being tightly connected. Now we are very dispersed. A lot of people are lonely. They're isolated. They've lost that social connection. So there are many aspects of modern life, while we are living longer, that are challenging us because we're adapted for a very different environment.
So that
disconnect is what puts us at greater risk for depression and Alzheimer's and cancer and heart disease. So there is a bit of a paradox there. We're getting a huge return on the investment of public health and certain pharmacologic breakthroughs, but we're now challenged to be more mindful as to how much discord exists between the world within which we live and just how well adapted we are biologically, genetically, ancestrally to thrive in that environment.
Now, Mark Pettis, your first medical degree, I believe, was as a nephrologist, a study of the kidney?
Yes, okay. Yeah.
So perhaps you could take the kidney and tell us how that fits into the paradigm of what you've just been discussing.
Yeah. So again, Dr. Shartok goes from the global to the nephron, the kidney.
Not necessarily.
I love that.
Not necessarily. Because the kidney may be representative of what we do.
Yeah.
We drink the wrong stuff.
Yeah,
we drink
absolutely.
Too much coffee, perhaps.
And I think it's a good place to look because the things that challenge us in modern life that are bad for the kidney are the same things that are bad for the heart, that are bad for our brains. So we know, for example, that more people today in 2015 have chronic kidney disease than any generation before them.
And what does the word chronic mean, Mark?
So chronic would imply, Alan, that a person has had abnormal kidney function for at least 6 months or longer.
Right.
And most people, as we've talked about in the past, Alan, have no symptoms when their kidneys are not working, so they can feel perfectly fine. If you look at the causes of kidney problems, high blood pressure, diabetes being the two biggest, a third would be what we call metabolic syndrome, this combination of obesity, particularly carrying weight around the midsection, high triglycerides, high blood pressure, all of those things are creating an epidemic of kidney disease, just as they are heart disease, just as they are stroke risk, just as they are Alzheimer's.
So you're talking about smoking.
Same root causes.
Yes.
So when you start looking at the modern environment, smoking would be very high on the list. If you look at the foods that we eat, for so many Americans, those foods tend to be processed, refined flour, refined grain-based foods, sugar, fructose.
How about salt?
Salt is a controversial topic these days. People are certainly consuming more salt than ever. And unfortunately, the sources of that salt does tend to be in fast foods and processed foods, which have very little nutritional value. All of those major changes in our food supply, and I would add to that list the amount of processed seed-based vegetable oils that we consume, corn oil, safflower oil, soy-based oils, all of those inputs are relatively new to the human experience. New meaning, you know, over the last maybe two generations, Alan.
Sure.
From an evolutionary biologic perspective, that's a blink of an eye. So we know that those changes will cause inflammation. They rev up our immune system, which is what inflammation is. A system designed to turn on and turn off quickly is turned on repeatedly, and for many people is in the on position all the time. It provokes this fight-flight response that we were just touching on. Also, a system designed to turn on and turn off quickly. Those things we know affect blood pressure, affect insulin resistance or diabetes. Our cells don't respond to insulin. And it's those fault lines that lead to kidney disease, that lead to heart disease, that lead to depression. We're now tying these fault lines to all of the chronic diseases that we know. Despite our longevity and despite all of our incredible biomedical breakthroughs, we've not made a dent in the extent to which these have become more problematic issues and the extent to which they're impacting quality of life for many Americans.
One of my favorite politicians, and that's what I study, is Michael Bloomberg. Always has been, because he knew all of this.
Yes.
And he would start talking about we have to drink less of the sodas and the rest of the stuff. And he got... Now, on the way back from Albany to Great Barrington, there are two places I stop. One I'm not going to name, but I stop every once in a while because I may need gas or whatever else. And I walk in there and I say, I'm going to look for something healthy to eat. There is nothing healthy in the entire store to eat. It's all processed, every bit of it. It's exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Then I stop at our other place, which I really like to go and which I am going to mention, which is the Public Market in West Stockbridge. I say that because they deserve all kinds of kudos. You go in there, and the guy, Tim, who runs it, is always looking for healthy things to buy, which are there. He also has the Coca-Cola, you know, and the rest of the stuff. I mean, he's not a prude, but he does look for that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I guess the larger question is, are we as a society guilty of something in that we say, okay, we've put this tremendous thing on about no smoking. Don't smoke. We want skulls and crossbones on the thing.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you go into the first place and it's almost criminal because it's killing people. Mm. And you've just said so.
Yes. So I've become more in this topic of mindfulness, Alan. I've tried to become more mindful in avoiding characterizing the way people choose in a judgmental, in a critical, in a punitive way. In part, though it is all about choosing wisely and choosing consciously, I do think for the average person, the challenge is recognizing that our environments are designed in a way that makes choosing wisely extraordinarily difficult. And a lot of the effect that these foods have on us can be powerfully addicting. And even with an amazing depth of knowledge and insight, these foods can drive behaviors and choices in ways that will trump one's knowledge that this may be good for them or bad for them. So part of that challenge, Alan, is it's easy to say that people are large because they're sloths. They just don't move or exercise that much, and they don't have the willpower. And at some level, maybe there's some truth to that, but the food industry knows that the biology induced by these foods will promote addiction and craving and if you're in a store that has nothing but
bad stuff,
and you are hungry, it will be impossible for you to exit that store
without a
bag of unhealthy chips or Fritos. The Dorito is the perfect example of a chemical engineering breakthrough where, you know, you can create any flavor you want, and that will light the brain up in much the same way that our brains used to light up when we caught a beautiful fish or, you know, harvested a beautiful plant. So we need to wake up. Part of the challenge of self-care is the recognition that you have to step back and wake up and come to grips with the fact that none of us are well designed to navigate this modern environment. And if you don't pause before each choice and begin to think about how you can influence choosing more wisely, you will come out the other end with choices that will not serve you well. And like most people, you end up in that slippery slide.
Now, every time I talk to you, Mark Pettis, I always have so many things I want to ask you about that I don't know what direction, you know, to go in. But let me tell you, I was addicted. This is a conversation I will admit that I was addicted.
Yeah.
I was addicted to Diet Pepsi and Coke.
Mm.
I don't know how
As
it
was
happened.
I.
I don't know how it happened, but somehow I bought the line, which was, this has zero calories in it.
Yeah.
When I stopped, and boy, it was like getting off something. I've never been on that other something, but I have the idea. I mean, I was drinking four or five of them a day, and you know, and I thought I was being mindful of the calories and the rest of it. I got off of it, and all of a sudden, I began to lose weight. In other words,
Go figure what
that was all about, what the unintended consequence of drinking this stuff, this stuff was. But I wanted to talk to you as in your role as associate dean of a medical college, and you talk to those students. I know that you talk about Dr. Burnout, you know, a lot.
Mm.
So I have people on Medical Monday here, as you know, you've been on, and they come in and they tell me, I like being here because I talk to 10,000 people at a time as opposed to single one after another, after another, after another. And I like getting the word out. But those doctors who are really now segregated from other doctors, in other words, one of the things that bothers me a lot is back in the old days when I was at Camp Bronx House, there was Dr. Bauerhan in Copaig. He handled everything. And then he would go in the back and he would compound the medicines himself. he would chop them up and he would do that. Now, you're 74 years old, I am, and you're going to find that you have to go to at least 8 different doctors on a regular basis because it's so segregated in terms of everybody having these specialties.
Yeah.
What do you make of all that?
Yeah, so I do find myself in an interesting place in that capacity, Alan. There is a growing disconnect between what most physicians, most caregivers anticipate the experience of caring for others will be. And that's true whether you're a medical student or moving on to your residency, about to become a practicing physician, or whether you're a physician who's been practicing, as I have, you know, for over 25, 30 years, there's a growing disconnect between the values, the reasons that you chose medicine as a career, and the actual experience of serving others. There's still very little emphasis on nutrition in medical school, surprisingly, more so than before. There's still very little emphasis on sort of lifestyle. And while more medical schools like UMass, which has always been ahead of the curve, thanks in large part to Jon Kabat-Zinn and a lot of his pioneering work on mindfulness-based stress reduction, there's still very little attention paid to these powerful mind-body connections. So physicians these days, forced to be seeing 25, 30 patients a day, they have a 10-minute precious period of time with agendas that are more complicated, people with lots of issues, not feeling well. You're forced to become very mission-oriented. What's the diagnosis? What is the pharmacologic approach that I can offer you that's efficient, it's quick?
Here's a pill.
Here's the bill.
A pill.
Here's the pill and the bill. That's a whole nother discussion. And both the consumer, if you will, and the provider of care come away very dissatisfied with the quality of that experience. Enter some of the changes that just in recent years around healthcare reform that now involve electronic health records. So physicians are having to integrate new computer systems. They bring their laptops into the examining room with you. So not only do you have precious little time, but now there is a computer between you, Alan Chartok, and your physician. There may or may not be any eye contact. Most of that encounter is going to be consumed by entering data. There is this fundamental lack of connection, interpersonal human connection. And for that provider, that physician who will maybe see 25, 30 patients that day, they'll get to the finish line, 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, and then he or she will have another couple hours of additional entering of data. And there is so little time, meaningful quality time spent in the way that you describe the old family practitioner sitting down, dropping anchor, and, you know, spending some quality time with you, that there's just this growing dissatisfaction. So we know that people are very dissatisfied with the quality of their encounters. More physicians are extremely dissatisfied with the quality of their professional lives, and to a large extent feel out of control in their ability to influence that, which is really what research is suggesting some of the major drivers of burnout to be. Less quality time with patients and those they serve, more bureaucratic paperwork and documentation that for many physicians has very little clear relevance to the relationship, to the encounter, to the provision of care. You've got more investment in the technology. For many physicians, there's less time interacting with their colleagues. So you can be in a busy office and literally not say one word to a colleague throughout the day because you're sprinting from one room to the next. So we've lost some of this social cohesiveness. And so for many physicians now, Alan, the joy is dissipated. You get to the end of the day, even when you're doing beautiful, noble, worthy work, and you look in the mirror and you think to yourself, geez, have I accomplished anything today? Mm. There's a sense of, you know, that the purpose tends to get lost in the context of our encounters. So a lot of physicians are struggling with that. And we know, Alan, that once providers, healthcare professionals, start to express burnout, lack of joy, lack of interest, losing the capacity to thrive, thinking about early retirement, the quality of care begins to drop as well. Physicians, after a while, start to give up on the notion that anything can change as a consequence of a 10-minute encounter. Physicians begin to throw their hands up and say, you know, I've got all these guidelines, all this evidence, and I have no time to apply it, to think about it. Physicians throw their hands up and say, Mrs. Smith needs help with her diet, needs help with movement, needs help managing her stress. And I really can't connect Mrs. Smith to anyone who can help her do that because her insurance won't pay for any of those things. So there's this sense of feeling totally overwhelmed. And while people may not feel inclined to feel empathetic for their physicians, their caregivers, I think their physicians and those they serve tend to have the same concerns about the encounter. Yet ours is a model that doesn't allow us to relate or connect in ways that can, you know, really engender the partnership. And you know this as well as anyone, Alan. It's really the relationship where the medicine is occurring, where the healing and therapy is evolving. It's not, Lipitor is not going to get you there. And it may be important as part of the guidelines, but most doctors today are thinking about statin, yes or no, LDL, too high, too low. It's very hard to immerse yourself in the biopsychosocial spiritual complexity of the human life sitting before you.
Do you also? I know you worked at Kripalu for a while, but, you know, somebody says to me, don't worry so much. Or somebody says to me, breathe in and breathe out. Mm. I don't know that we really have the tools. I know we're going to disagree on this, but that we really have the tools to tell people how to thoroughly relax, get out of the caveman mode.
Yes. And I don't disagree with you, Alan. I think that's a huge issue. People needing help don't have the tools, and those they go to for help often don't have the tools to share with them. And even for those who maybe have some knowledge of mind-body skills, breath, a little meditation, or nutrition, rarely is there time to leverage that knowledge or expertise. You won't get paid for it. It won't be part of the checklist that the insurer or CMS, the government, Medicare, needs you to be checking. So you're right, Alan. There is a disconnect between what people need and the likelihood that they're going to receive that in the context of their encounters. And you brought up a question, Alan. I don't mean to pontificate.
I'm delighted.
But there's plenty to worry about. And there are people who worry a lot, the worried well, and maybe you see yourself in that category, Alan. You know, there are still, at the end of all that worrying, people who can come to a place of recognizing that it's still not the end of the world. I can still get through the day. I've been here before, and I've found ways to navigate those challenges. I'm more resilient. I can still prevent a lot of what I'm worried about from impacting how I love my wife, how I love my kids, how I love and engage my work. And then there are people who, in the context of that pervasive worrying, have no skills to fall back on, no supports, no resources, knowledge, perhaps financial. And there are a lot of people, as you know, that are in that category, Alan. If you look at the Berkshires, most people are surprised to learn that the Berkshires are one of the poorest counties in the state of Massachusetts.
Fascinating.
And
because we think just the opposite.
We think just the opposite. And when you look at the social determinants of health, education, socioeconomics, things that you often allude to in your programming, our health system is not designed to help people really address those issues. And it's just another reason that people, providers, are sort of burning out and have no place to go. And those seeking care tend to look elsewhere for their care because they simply cannot get what they need from the quality of the encounters that they're engaged in.
Mark Pettis, that's one of the problems. There are an awful lot of phonies around. You know, who set up one kind of practice or another based on, you know, this need which can't be met.
Yeah, very hard to separate the science from the snake oil, Alan. And even though we're in the midst of this knowledge revolution, explosion of knowledge, it can be very hard to translate that in a way that can serve your best interest. And I do think, and one of my mantras, and this is very much part of an integrated health model, is that all care is self-care. Ultimately, we have to become more effective stewards of self-care. And I do think there are instances where we know enough to know how to apply some small changes. And for some people, it may be just eating less sugar, drinking a few less sugar-sweetened beverages a day, taking a few more steps a day. A lot of the success there requires, and we all need help doing this, is working on the environment. It's creating, people have to change their environment. What's in their cupboards, who they're friendly with and connected with, how many emails they're going to decide to manage over the course of the day, how much time in the computer they're going to spend. We have to begin to look at creative ways to alter our environment in ways that, as modern humans, wired for the African savanna, but living in this interesting and challenging modern world, can make it easier for us to choose wisely. If I have ice cream in my freezer, Alan, and I too am a sugar addict, a reformed sugar addict, I will not be able to go to bed at night without a large dose of that ice cream. It simply will not happen. I have plenty of knowledge, and I know the implication of that. So I have to control my environment. And the way that I control that is I talk to my beautiful wife, Leanne. I say, you know, honey, there's just certain things we can't have in the house because I can't trust myself when those things are around.
I say that to Roselle, but then she goes and buys it because she wants it herself. Yeah. And who are you to tell me I can't have my ice cream?
You're always good when you're on the same page, but yeah. But that creates, you know, that's an added challenge for sure. Yeah.
So you wrote a book, an early book called The Savvy Patient. Mm. You know, and I think a lot of people who are listening right now are going to want to know, considering all the things you've just talked about, alienation, you know, sort of segregation of the various doctor functions. You know, you go to a dentist now and you get one dentist who cleans your teeth and one dentist who puts in, you know, bridges and another dentist who, there are like four different dentists you have to go to. In the old days, one dentist.
Right.
So what is the savvy patient to do?
I think one of the most important questions for the savvy patient to begin to embrace is, particularly when you find yourself confronting a decision where you feel lost, and so many people feel lost, is what would my grandparents, great-grandparents have done under these circumstances? Which food would they have chosen? And your grandparents, my grandparents, great-grandparents could walk into most of our supermarkets and not recognize most of what's on the shelf. So I think your savvy patients, Alan, it's always good to start with, first of all, a sense that you're not locked into the trajectory or the path that you may think you are on or locked in. Part of self-care and the challenge of self-care is deconstructing these perceptions that guide the way you think about what's possible in your life. So an example of that, real quickly, Alan, is that we now know that we're not prisoners of our DNA, this epigenetic science, the notion that your genes can be turned on and off in response to the choices you make.
Well, what about the BRAT, for example, gene, where somebody gets breast cancer as a result of having this gene? That's not choice, is it?
So certainly the BRCA gene is an example of something that puts a woman at great risk for breast or ovarian cancer. Yet if you look at women who are BRCA positive in 2015, their risk of cancer is much greater than it was in women who BRCA positive in 1980.
That's interesting. How come?
Because our environment, I would make the case, is more carcinogenic. It is more cancer-producing. So that genetic card that you're holding puts you at greater risk. But women today are at even greater risk than they were, despite an equal genetic risk, because the environment has become more cancer-promoting, as an example. So there are genes that are powerful, and BRCA is an important one, Alan. But we've come to appreciate that there really are no diabetes genes. There really are no heart disease genes per se. So from a savvy patient perspective, I always start from a place of helping people believe what's possible. Because what's possible for most people, I think, is beyond what they might perceive to in fact be possible. That they could entirely transform their lives by bringing those environmental choices, how they eat, how they move, how they interpret and respond to stress, how they navigate the minefields of conflict, how socially connected they are, how much meaning they cultivate in their lives. The more aligned those choices are with that sort of Stone Age imperative, the more their genes will translate in a health-promoting way. So the savvy patient really would do well by asking themselves, geez, you know, what would my grandparents or great-grandparents have done under these circumstances? They probably would have walked more. They probably would have chosen foods that were real foods, whole foods, not processed foods. Not that we can live like we did in 1900. There are ways that we can enjoy all of the modern advances of life. But on some level, we need to be more ancestral in how we think about the environment within which we exist. So
I want to argue with you, Mark, as I did before. I don't want to be repetitive, but they died earlier. Your grandparents died earlier. Now, I think your argument's going to be, let me see if I can figure this out, that because we have more tools, we live longer, but we could live even longer if we did some of the intuitive things that our grandparents did.
Exactly, Alan. So I think the way that I picture this is the average American has a dramatic drop in their quality of life as they get older, so much so that most people look at those around them and think that putting on weight, being more tired, losing your libido is a natural, normal, inevitable consequence of the aging process because everyone around me seems to be on that exact same path. What I'm suggesting is that one can take that quality of life and extend it for a longer part of that age continuum. Very much made possible by many modern breakthroughs, though I would argue that most of those breakthroughs are public health, and you know, these are not, I would not give science all the credit for the reason that we are living longer, though it is certainly a major role in that. But people can be living well for a longer part of that life continuum. The health span can be expanded.
Sure.
So that's where lifestyle and mindfulness and choosing more wisely has the greatest impact, in ways that Lipitor, another angioplasty, a bypass operation, will not afford you. We know that you can certainly prevent death at a particular point in time, but people are living longer now with a burden of chronic complex disease that no generation before us has ever experienced. So we all want to live long, we all want to live well, and it ultimately becomes a combination of not just great breakthroughs, but also how we care for ourselves. And I would make the case that the latter has a greater influence on that equation.
Okay, so Mark Pettis, when the savvy patient walks into the doctor's office, what savviness should should they? I mean, I'm trying to bring it down to its most rudimentary. I once knew a doctor who said the worst thing that he ever saw was, and there's been some real disagreement on this, was that when somebody came into his office and said, I have a list, and he would say, the guy said, beware of the man with the list.
With the list.
So what do you look for in that doctor? How do you make that demand that the doctor treat you well?
And I do think it does help as a savvy patient, savvy consumer, to prepare for a visit, to anticipate the time will be limited and precious, as most people do, to prioritize the questions, the issues that are weighing most heavily. And what I look for in my provider is, are they making eye contact with me? Do they appear to be in the moment with me? Do they appear to be listening to what it is I'm suggesting? Are they open? Are they comfortable saying, you know, I've never heard of that supplement that you're taking, Alan, or I'm not aware of what Reiki can do. I don't know a lot about meditation, but I know that it can help a lot of people, and I'm open to your doing that. Or here are some resources that you may want to consider to examine that aspect of your care. So I think the open-mindedness, the attentiveness, and I do look for the mood that my provider is in, and I prefer that my provider be in a good mood, be a bit more upbeat. I will observe, as many people do when they're in a doctor's office, of how are they relating to their colleagues in the office? What is the emotional landscape like for that practice? Is the assistant, when you walk in, upbeat, or is she so mission-oriented that she's not even looking at you and saying, you know, Alan, I'm sorry, you can't be seen again for another month, even though you have an issue that requires more prompt follow-up? You know, so I do think one can get a sense of what the dynamic is like in a practice by just observing and looking at what people are doing.
Well, now you've had a lot of jobs, and they've all been very prestigious. However, you have not been afraid to go from one to the other. I've always been impressed by that. Tell us a little about that.
So thanks, Alan. Yeah, so it's been an interesting journey for me, Alan. And most of the changes that I've made in my professional life and in my personal life, I would have never predicted. I would have never imagined. And like most change, it can bring to some rather enlightening experiences and observations. So when both my parents died of kidney diseases, ironically—
Is that why you became a nephrologist?
No, actually, all of this happened after I completed my training. But they suffered horribly, Alan. And as a caregiver and as a kidney guy, every decision that was made with respect to their care required my blessing. It was impossible for me to be the son, the caregiver. I was also the doctor. And I realized that most of what they suffered with was preventable. And when I began to think about
how could they have prevented it?
They could have been better educated with respect to nutrition. They could have gotten more help, perhaps. Now, some of this was the time of their lives.
Absolutely. My father would go in the bathroom and smoke. I know he would.
Exactly. You know, so.
And he was dead 3 years before I am right now, to put it mildly.
Yeah.
And he looked very different from the way that I think I look right now. So we can look back on our parents and say they could have done that differently, I suppose.
And I see, and it's not to be critical of my parents, but the way that I interpret that, Alan, is in 2015, we know a lot more than we did a generation ago. So as a caregiver, and as someone who's also vested in self-care, I have a lot to gain from that. How can I translate what we know in 2015 to those today who are no different than my parents were a generation ago? Smoking, high blood pressure, diabetes, many of whom think it's locked into their genes and there's nothing that they can possibly influence. So I acquired nutrition as a second language, which for most physicians, you have to break out of the script that you've been taught to do so. I've learned a lot of these mind-body skills. You know, I love being on the faculty of the Center for Mind-Body Medicine and Leonard Perlmutter's program at the American Meditation Institute. Part of the mission there is to train physicians, to educate them, to give them skills that not only can they apply in their own self-law, in their own self-care, but to help others navigate some of these health challenges. So each of those chapters has brought me to a different place and has more or less kept me, I think, this interesting juxtaposition between older ways of thinking and more contemporary ways of advancing this.
Mark, as you've been discussing physicians, the one thing I haven't heard you talk about as they make choices is money.
Mm.
You know, I know some physicians who, you know, are very angry about the fact that their predecessors would be, in proportion, be making a lot more money than they're making now.
Yeah.
And, you know, they may have all of the great rationales for being a doctor and say all of those things. But in the end, they want to make $300,000-$400,000 a year. Mm. And they're not doing that, especially, you know, internists and family doctors.
Yeah. It's a really good point. And I'm always careful talking about money when it comes to physicians because, you know, not surprisingly, the average consumer is not going to be too empathetic to how much money a doctor's bringing home at the end of the week. But if, in fact, you look at many of those trends, Alan, and doctors work extraordinarily long hours, they come out of medical school today with more debt than ever. The average medical student who graduates, this is 4 years of college and then 4 years of medical school, will have anywhere from $150,000 to $200,000 plus of debt. Healthcare reform, and we spend a lot in healthcare, and you know, I would never question that, has led to significant reductions in reimbursement that many physicians receive, particularly, as you mentioned, Alan, the primary care providers. And if you look at burnout, it's those frontline providers, those that are in the trenches, the pediatricians, the family practitioners, the internists, the emergency department folks that are really at the interface of the public and the medical community that have seen some of the greatest changes in those areas. And so while income has dropped significantly for a lot of healthcare professionals, there's been a dramatic rise in their overhead. So more physicians now, particularly in private practice, they have to pay for health insurance for their staff, just as any company or small business
would.
But
it's also why they're selling out, I don't mean this in a bad way, to the hospitals who are buying all of these practices
exactly.
And then assuming all of those costs, even though the physician might not make as much as they would hope.
Exactly, Alan. And that's one of the greatest reasons that more physicians are becoming employed. If you look at how much it costs to put in new computer systems and electronic records, to have the expertise to manage those information systems, more and more physician practices in the Albany market and the Berkshire market are having no choice but to move toward employment models. And many feel that they're doing it not because they're choosing to do it, but because they have no choice but to do it in order to survive. And so I do think that that is a reflection of sort of the economic regulatory landscape in medicine right now. And it's another one of the many contributors to the burnout that we've been touching on.
I wanted to talk to you a little bit about one of my favorite concepts, and that's, I've often been called on this, but as you probably know, Freud said that our characters are set by the time we're 4 years old.
Mm.
And you've been talking about our approach to, and that it's very hard to change our character, almost impossible.
Yes.
I know a woman I know very well who I think her character was changed because she was in the World Trade Center at 9/11. And she escaped by 5 minutes due to a happenstance. Mm. I think her character changed. I do. But
yes.
I think for the most part, character does not change.
Mm.
So when you're advising us to watch the way we breathe, what we eat, you know, our paranoia, incipient paranoia, the rest of that stuff. How do we know that that wasn't what happened to us by the time we were 4 years old? And is it really doable?
Mm. Is it really doable, I think, is the million-dollar question, Alan. There was a time where I thought that most of that was etched at a very young age, and I think there's some truth to that. But I've shifted my thinking about the capacity for any human being to change, not that it's easy. And it's become so challenging that I think we do tend to assume that these are patterns that are locked in at a young age. What I see in the life sciences, whether it's the neuroplasticity of the brain, the capacity of the brain to change patterns of connections, communication, which we know translate in different ways of thinking, behaving, different emotional responses. When I look at epigenetics, the notion that Alan Chartok's DNA, Book of Life, certainly you came into the world with that. You had very little control over that. Epigenetics is suggesting that the environment can take that Book of Life and radically change the way it is translated. The scientists are suggesting that we have much more plasticity, much more active and dynamic capacity to adapt. So I do think the potential for change, challenging though it is much greater than what we have historically thought. And part of helping another individual move in a direction that can better serve them does require deeper relationships than what exists for the most part in our healthcare systems, help with the environment within which they live, connecting them to other people in their lives, group support, group dynamic, developing capacity in our communities, this notion of social capital, creating healthy communities with whether it's bike paths and farm-to-table models of food preparation. These are challenging issues, but I do think the suggestion is that we can change, and that we can change not just as individuals, but as neighborhoods and as communities. But it requires a very different sort of model, structure, how we are incentivized. And it can take time, particularly when the lens through which a person looks at their lives has been so heavily influenced by their childhood experiences, by their adult experiences. And I do think you're right, Alan, that there are certain noteworthy traumatic events like 9/11, maybe losing a loved one, confronting a life-threatening health problem. People often do require that magnitude of trauma in order to begin to see the world differently than how they have seen it. But I do think there are more subtle and significant ways that we can help people begin to shift the way they view their lives and how they can begin to respond differently. And part of that is recognizing, as we've been talking about, that our environments are not well suited to enable that possibility to emerge. And a lot of the work that I'm doing in population health, our Department of Public Health grant work, a lot of the work that we're doing in Northern Berkshire County is really to try to develop more community capital through places like the Y, Councils of Aging, Northern Berkshire Community Coalition. You have to meet people where they're at.
How important is your boss? I mean, I know David Phelps fairly well there, and he and I are friends, and all the rest of it. You know, those of us who have written PhD dissertations, albeit many years ago, you know, in difficult situations, to what degree is freedom of action based on one's relationship with one's boss mean something? And let me just also say, while I'm on the subject, with one's spouse. You know, people outgrow each other sometimes. One goes faster than the other, one holds back. I mean, how does that all affect our well-being?
Yeah, I think those relationships and the quality of those relationships are enormous contributors. In the example of Mr. Phelps, so he's the CEO, and everything does start at the top. And it certainly helps as I attempt to move my agenda when the CEO has had more personal experiences with respect to health and lifestyle. And I don't think, you know, Dave would mind publicly. He has gone out many times, and I've been present with him, talking about his own experience of being diagnosed with diabetes, turning it around with lifestyle, beginning to see the value and the potential for change, but also recognizing that there's a big difference between being a large organizational CEO and being an average person in Berkshire County who may not have the knowledge, the skill, or the resources. So there's been a significant, from Dave's perspective down, awareness and recognition of the importance of doing more of this work and investing in more of this work.
It makes your job easier.
And it makes my job a lot easier. So I have this very simple philosophy, Alan. Most of what I do to serve that which I value. And in order to do that, I don't worry so much about title. I do it one relationship at a time. And ultimately, it's a matter of understanding the values of that person I'm in relationship with, their perceptions, and what I can do to behave in a way that will transform their perceptions, that will lead to a behavior that will serve them and me better than we're currently served.
What about spouse?
So for me, every relationship is unique. So in the example of my marriage, it's been really important that we, Leanne and I, have spent a lot of time more openly and purposefully working together around many of the lifestyle things, how we eat, what we buy, what is prepared, how much time we give each other to unplug and to nurture. Everything is an investment. And, you know, for us, it's been a matter of recognizing the value of that and the need to be investing more time and energy into that. And people with successful and long marriages, as you have had, Alan, do tend to live longer. There's some interesting public health data there than people who have been divorced or struggling to maintain the capacity to thrive in the relationships that they're in. So we know that there are health consequences of relationships that are probably deep and impact us in many ways.
If you were giving us, and we only have 5 minutes left, rules to live by, what is it that you would say to us? You know, there was the Japanese general in The Bridge on the River Kwai who said, be happy in your work. You know, it's somewhat facetious, but that is what he said. You've told us to be very careful about what we eat. You've also talked about working together with a spouse to make sure that we can, you know, at least compromise on what we have to do in order to go forward and to succeed. But we do also know that economics has a lot to do with it, that if you don't have the money, you made that point just a minute ago, if you don't have the money, you can't really make choices that other people can. So what's your list look like?
That's a great question. And I would probably start, Alan, by recommending that people simplify their lives to the extent that they can. And by simplifying, I come back to this ancestral lens. Where can I end choices in my life, align those choices with some of those ancestral values? And again, that may be choosing the less processed food or the food that has less sugar in it, or a beverage that's not a sweetened or artificially sweetened soft drink. It may involve looking at relationships, as we've talked about, and there are some that are toxic and some that maybe we're better off letting go of. There are some that need more work and certainly worthy of the investment of time and energy. And then I would say lastly, Alan, it's connect yourself with as many positive, caring, compassionate people as you can. Social groups, I think, are enormously important. That cohesiveness is enormously important. Relationships rule, and I think that's the currency, and the extent to which people often need help fostering that, you know, is you know, try to find that help. But I would say simplifying one's life, it's that ancestral lens that can bring us to a place where our biology, which has a lot of wisdom over the last 2.5 million years of evolution and adaptation, can begin to take us to places that we might had not have appreciated were even possible. So I guess that would be the...
So easy to say, Mark Pettis, but I have images of my maternal grandmother. The stories of putting a piece of sugar between her teeth as she drinks her tea, you know, or an uncle who just ate schmaltz and chicken fat and, you know, and ate herring and terrible cream sauces and the rest of it. It's easy to make heroes out of these people, but sometimes it ain't true.
Well, you know, we can all think of examples, but I would also, maybe this would be a conversation for another interview, Alan. There are a lot of things that we look at today as unhealthy, like fat, that we're learning are not really that unhealthy at all. I think what was different for the generations before us is that of the options afforded to them, more of them tended to be healthier than the options afforded to us today. And we're all challenged to find ways to choose more wisely. But ultimately, you know, the more simple we design our lives, whether it's just taking a deep breath, whether it's reaching out and embracing someone that maybe needs to be embraced, whether it's changing one or two simple things and seeing how you respond to that, can bring you to places you would not have imagined being brought to. I think that's, for me, the take-home message.
We've been talking with Dr. Mark Pettis, one of the people who I appreciate the most in the world, who currently serves as the Director of Medical Education, Wellness, and Population Health at Berkshire Health Systems in Western Massachusetts. Mark, as always, you've been a great friend to this station and to me. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Real pleasure, Alan. Thank you.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.